How goes the day?
Good. Just got back from Australia not long ago, so getting on the right time zone.
Welcome back to Canada.
Thank you.
And for the listeners, you are located in Toronto. Am I right?
That's correct.
Yeah, you guys were gone for a while. That was a
Yeah,
busy
it was
trip.
the end of October.
Yeah. Feels good to be home.
Yes.
Yeah. After so many hotel rooms, it's just like. No, that's amazing. Well, welcome back. Tammy, for the listeners, we can talk about various topics. Obviously, one is your illness, grief, and to those areas. But how did you get out there? That's really interesting to me because oftentimes, we can be in the shadows and it's like yourself coming from a small town in Alberta, Fairview, it's hard to get out there publicly, very publicly. Let's just say that I'm in Calgary, so Alberta represent.
So, I think from the time I was very young, I like to record myself singing. I like to play the piano and sing. So I was always interested in some kind of performance. But that's not what I spent my life doing. I was a massage therapist for 30 years, which is very quiet. It's a very quiet thing to do. But when Jord went on tour the first time, and I sat in the audience, I just was doing the next right thing, really. I was working as, I guess, the tour assistant, and I just made sure that he got to every venue and he had food and a place to stay in the next flight. And, I was just making sure that the whole thing went along smoothly. And, this fall when we went on tour, last fall when we went on tour, my daughter was opening the show and she was doing the Q&A. And she did a couple of shows, maybe three shows, and then decided that she was too busy, that she had many other things, and that this was too much to also add onto the agenda. And Jordan asked me, and I had never been on stage. Right. And I had never spoken publicly. But I decided that was an opportunity and I said yes. And I've thought about that since and I've wondered what happened. And I think because I listened to him for a very long time, so I was there in the audience listening to probably 200 lectures, like a lot of lectures. And also, being in support of his work. So I was not hesitating and I wasn't trying to work against it. And I wasn't trying to be the person either. I was just doing the next right thing, whatever seemed necessary, I was doing. And I think by the time he asked me to go on stage, he trusted that I could do it because I had pretty much taken care of everything so far. And I think that's how, why it came about is that because I had every day stepped up to whatever was necessary, when the next challenge came about, he turned to me and asked me because it was, in a way, it happened organically. It was just one thing after the next until finally that was the next thing. And he asked me, and I said yes. Now, when I first went on stage, I would read a chapter from his book, and then I'd think about how it affected me, and I would talk about that. And I hadn't really even told any stories. So at first, I imagined that the stories weren't that compelling. Even if the subject matter was compelling, my delivery might not have been. But now I've done probably another 100. And this time I've been on stage. And so my tour manager, who was a stand-up comedian for 20 years, now and then gives me a thumbs up. So I know that I've actually delivered a story that was compelling. And so that's my goal now, is to be a successful storyteller, even though my story is only about 10 minutes long. So it has to be succinct, right? It has to be the moral, the story, and everything has to fit in that 10 minutes. And that's a challenge on its own. In terms of the crowd, because sometimes there's 4,000 people. Once in Australia, there were 13,000 people. So these are big crowds. But I don't have stage fright. And before I go on stage, I ask God for courage and strength. And I prepare before I go on stage, but I don't take any paper with me. Sometimes I'll read a quote from his book, so I'll have that on my phone so I can read it properly. But other than that, I rehearse what story I want. I know what the story is, but I just go out there and I tell it in my own words, which I think is the best way to keep it fresh and to be authentic, because it has to come from what I remember.
Mm-hmm. Authenticity, that's something.
It's what I remember, you know, it's what I remember and how I understand it. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great challenge. I've really enjoyed it.
Authenticity is key. I mean, you know, rehearsing something and hearing someone say it over and over again, it wears down. But when it comes from the heart and it comes from up there, there's a difference, isn't there?
Yes, definitely. There's a difference. And I think that the people in the crowd know that. One of the things I talked about was on our way from California to New Zealand, I went to Hawaii and stayed there for 4 days, which is a really good idea, actually, because when you go to Hawaii, you get on the time zone of Hawaii. When you go to Australia, it's 23 hours different. So you're only 1 hour out. So I recommend that for anybody heading over to Australia. That worked out really well. I didn't feel jet lagged at all.
Where in Hawaii did you stay?
We were in Honolulu. My sister-in-law's daughter is going to university. And so we went to visit her. Yes. And she wanted to go swim with sharks. And so I said, okay. My husband said, you can't go swim with sharks. Yeah. I don't want you to swim with sharks. And I said, well, I think I'm going to go anyway. So we went 3.5 miles offshore with this company that takes people out to swim with sharks. They're marine biologists and they want people to understand what sharks are like because, they're hunted. They're hunted a lot. And so it was very interesting. She told us to get in the water, that she would get in the water first and that she would try to stay between us and the sharks. Mm. And so I got in the water and she said, the only thing you have to remember is to, if they look at you, you look at them. Because if you look at them, they know that you're a predator. They know you're not food and they'll just swim by. And that is what it was like. You made sure you swam with the school so you weren't offending them or you weren't threatening them. And when they swam by, you looked at that beady little eye, and some of them were 11 feet long. They were Galapagos sharks. They were big sharks, but we swam around with them for nearly an hour.
Yeah, they can sense fear. Same with various animals. It's almost, how do you calm yourself down in such a moment? It's scary.
Yeah. Well, we were told not to splash and, just to be very mindful, to make sure we knew where the boat was, where she was and where the sharks were, and to keep that all in mind. And it was a great experience. It was beautiful to look down into the water, and the water's all blue and the sharks are gray with a little bit of green on their back. I don't know if that's moss or if it's just the color of them. Probably so that it's a type of camouflage or something, maybe
protect them.
But they're very smooth and elegant in the water. Yeah. So it was a great experience.
Are you still practicing singing and dancing and any of that stuff?
I'm practicing singing. We've recorded some songs over the last year. We have a very good musician that we work with, and he plays the guitar. And then my husband writes the lyrics, and then we all sing, and then he does all the mixing. And so we haven't put out the music yet, but I think we have 9 songs. And a couple of them I sing predominantly in them. Mm-hmm. And so that's very cool.
Super cool. Is it more folk-like?
Is it more folk? They're different, actually. There's a couple that are kind of punk rock.
Super cool.
There's a couple that are country type. Mm-hmm. And so there's a variety. There's a variety of songs.
Growing up, who was some of your influences in terms of lyrics and music and sound?
When I was very young, my dad had a collection of records. Mm-hmm. And he had a Peggy Lee record. So that was good. She's quite a good singer. And my brother was 8 years older than me. And so he collected records and I played their records. You know, the Beatles were, I had Beatles on 45s when I was little. And I was the youngest kid. So when everyone was gone to school, I used to play records. And my brother collected Elton John and David Bowie. And we were listening to Frank Zappa. We were listening to all kinds. And, you know, Led Zeppelin. Jordan listened to a lot of Led Zeppelin when he was in high school. And I hung around. We drove around together and listened to Led Zeppelin. So, you know, lots of different. And on the radio station, it was all country and Western, as you know, because you're from Alberta. So I had, you know, and I used to listen on TV. We used to have him sing on Sunday, so I'd listen to hymns. But we also had, what was it? Don, it was a country music hour. Messenger, what was his last name? I can't remember what the show was, but it was in when I was a younger teenager. And I would listen to those every week. So I really liked just to listen to singing on TV. I was always very interested. And my aunt, my dad's sister, was a singer. And she sang with a group until she was elderly. The Sweet Adelines, they were called, and they would tour around Canada. And my dad's mother was a piano player, and she played for the church. And then she toured around for a while and played at different old folks' home when she was old. So there's been some music in the family. And my son plays guitar and sings. So there's some music. And George loves music. Mm-hmm. So it has been something that's followed me through my life. I haven't been able to actually perform until recently, but I never really expected to have that happen. So I'm just thrilled that it's even a possibility.
I think I was listening to something where Jordan was saying that you and him dance often.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty cool. And so we set up a date routine when we were just married and when we had our first child. As soon as we had our first child and we were sleep deprived and very, very busy, Jordan thought we weren't spending enough time together, and I suggested that we schedule our dates. And he said, scheduling dates doesn't sound very spontaneous. And I said, yeah, but when we were dating, we scheduled dates. So I think that it would be just fine if we scheduled dates. So he agreed. And once he agreed, once you get Dr. Peterson to agree to something, he's going to do it, and you're going to have to do it because he's agreed. And so we would have dates 3 times a week. And the rules were that you couldn't look at your email or phone anyone or answer the door. You had to be spending time together. And, you know, sometimes we didn't have babysitters and we didn't have any relatives. So we would put our daughter to sleep at 8 o'clock at night, and then we'd have a date. And as time went by, we had a routine. So the routine would be, first of all, that we would agree to have a date. And that meant that the day of the date, you'd know that you should have a rest, because you don't want to be bitchy and tired. And so having a rest was a good idea. You'd have a shower. You would each have a shower and put on something nice. He would tidy up the living room and light some candles and put on some music. And then I would come in the room and we would dance. And, you know, for a number of years, dancing was a small part of it. But as we've got older, dancing has become a very central part of it. And because dancing is something you can do. My dad and his wife now, his second wife, they danced on Friday nights at a senior's dance until he must have been 88 years old, you know? So you can dance really forever together. And so I think really it's one of the most important things that you do in a marriage is learn to dance with each other. And Jordan and I have taken very few lessons. We took some lessons because I wanted to take lessons, but life always got in the way and that never worked out very well. But we have an understanding of how to dance together and it's fine. And it's just fine. And we like similar music and we are always tweaking the playlists. You know, if I find some song that I think is like New York, New York, Frank Sinatra, that's just so over the top. I just like, no, you know, that doesn't fit. And so now and then I'll put a kibosh on a song, but we probably have 24 hours of music that we've compiled and put together in a playlist. So we don't really have to listen to the same song very often if we don't want to. And it's a good way to, even if you don't want to have a date, even if you haven't been getting along, but you've agreed to have a date and you don't want to do it, you know what you have to do. You have to have a shower. You have to get into mm-hmm. something nice and you have to present yourself to the other person in good faith. And so even if you're not interested or you have something else on your mind, the practice of doing like is like any other practice, a practice of prayer, any kind of practice that you might have, you get better at it. And so through getting ready, by the time that you're in the same room together, some of the resistance is gone. And then you dance together for a while and a little more of the resistance is gone. And so you can relate to one another by the time you've got there, you've danced, you're more or less in the same frame of mind by that time. So it's been a very good practice. And we've been doing this now for 34 years. So long yeah. time.
How long have you guys been married?
34 years.
34 years. Oh, seriously, from day one.
Yeah, really. Because, well, I think, well, let's see, Michaela was born 92. We were married in 89. So more like 30 years.
Growing up in Fairview, Alberta, what are some of the values that you guys have now applied 34 years later?
Fairview. Fairview is a very small town, right? There's 2,000 people there. And we used to go to school in the dark. I don't know in Calgary if it's like that, but the sun didn't come up before 9 and the sun went down before you got out of school. So it was dark all winter.
Oh, yes.
And so you went out at lunch. And going outside for me was very important because the teachers needed us to go outside at lunch. Otherwise, we got no vitamin D. So, and then in the spring, when the sun would start coming back and the water would start to flow, or when there was a Chinook, and it would warm up for a week once the clouds disappeared and the sun shone, and it would go from minus 25 to 5 above and then stay there for 4 days and then go back down to minus 25. I think that we really cherished good weather. And I still cherish good weather. Whenever I have something to mull over, I go outside and I go for a walk. And we like to, when we're on tour, all we're doing really is taking one plane and then the next day another plane. But we'll usually go for a walk sometime in that city, wherever we are. and get a sense of the city, get a sense of the people. And I think that that's something that has followed us through from this little town, is always getting outside and seeing what the day is like, because it's never the same as looking out the window. It's always a surprise how cold it is, how warm it is, how strong the wind is. And often, even in the winter, it's never as cold outside as you think it's going to be, as long as you're dressed warm.
Next week for us, yeah, it's going to be a chilly one.
Oh, is that right? What's the weather like there?
Right now it's about minus 15.
Minus 15, yeah. No. Alberta has brutally cold winters. But, you know, I lived in Montreal and Ottawa, and the humidity in those cities in the winter, the cold goes right to your bones. And it's not like that in Alberta. You can put on downfill coat and mitts and a toque and some good boots, and you're good to go. Whereas in Montreal, you need wool sweaters. You have to insulate, right? You have to insulate, and you have to have waterproof boots, because they use a lot of salt. And so there's just slush everywhere. It's much, much different. Mm-hmm. Winter, I had to really get used to it. As soon as I moved to Montreal, my hiking boots were ruined, because there was so much salt on the roads that it would just seep through the leather. So no leather boots.
Out west, we say, do not buy a car from the east because of the salt, the rust.
Yeah, that's right. That's true, because it just rots the undercarriage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you moved from Fairview, Alberta, you were married there, I'm guessing.
Went home and were married there. We dated in grade 12. Hmm. And saw each other every year or two, but I didn't move to Montreal and get engaged until I was 26. And so we were living in Montreal, and we decided I wanted to get married in Montreal, but Jordan said no, he wanted to go home. He was the oldest in his family. I was the youngest in my family. So we'd already had three weddings. My parents already had lots of grandchildren by the time I got married. But on his side, there were no grandchildren and there were no marriages. And so for him, going home to get married in this little town was important. So we went home. And as it turned out, you know, many of our relatives couldn't have come all the way to Montreal. It would have been a small venue here, and it still wasn't big. There were 145 people. It was a small wedding, but all of our relatives were able to come. My grandmother came, his grandmother, his grandfather, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was the right choice.
On your side, is mom and dad still around?
Jordan's mom and dad still live in that little town. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Have you guys gone back to visit that town?
We have. We went back last January.
Oh, yes.
And then we went back in August. We went before, we went on tour. I can't remember where we were leaving to. We might have been off to Australia last year, or I'm not quite sure where we were going, but we decided that we better go visit. So we went to visit my father on Vancouver Island, and we went up to the Peace River country and visited his parents. And then we felt more secure in leaving and going on the road. And so that has how we do it now, is before we go on tour, we go and see the people in our lives who are old or ill. We go see them before we leave, and then we know where they are. We can tell how well they are, and if anything has to be taken care of, if everything is stable, then we can go and feel good about it. Actually, Jordan's mother and his aunt came with us to Australia, and she's 83 years old. So it was really good. She had always, that was on her bucket list, Australia. So she came for the whole tour.
And what a beautiful way to see her family members on stage and people listening. And what an experience for the mom.
Yeah, what an experience. Yeah. And sometimes I could see her in the front row. So that was really neat.
I love it. So she's almost become your mom in a way, because
yes, I
mean, that many years later. Yeah.
And my mom passed away in 2007. And so, but, you know, I knew Bev Peterson when I was a child because they lived in our neighborhood. I didn't know her well. She worked, so she wasn't around a lot, but I knew who she was. And sometimes I went over to Jordan's house and she was there, but his father taught me grade six. So I knew him in a way that was unusual. I knew him quite well. But Mrs. Peterson and I were good friends, and we've spent a lot of time together. When I was ill, she was with me a lot of the time. She came a couple of times and spent, I don't even know how many weeks with me, a long time.
When you go back to Fairview, do you see a lot of friends of yours or family members, or is it a whole new generation now there?
I don't have any family around there in the local area of Fairview anymore. And Jordan, it's really just his parents that live there. But I have one friend who I've connected with only just in the last year. We were friends in grade two, so a very long time. And she's been there all along. She got married and raised her children there and now has grandkids. But it's been nice to visit with her. And it's funny because when I was in the hospital and sick with kidney cancer, she had kidney failure at the same time for a completely different reason. And we only realized that last summer. And I went over and spent 3 hours speaking with her about her experience. She was, doctors weren't able to diagnose what was going on. She ended up going to Mexico to get treatment and survived because she was, you know, in a very tough place. And she has really taken her faith much more seriously as I have. So that's been good.
In small towns, faith is highly important, of course. You know, you guys go to church on Sunday. It's a thing in a small town compared to a big city. Were you always practicing faith, or did it obviously amplify after your illness?
Well, it definitely amplified after my illness. But as a child, I went to church on Sundays. And as a young girl, I joined Explorers and CGIT. So I did the Christian girls in training. You know, I did that with my sisters. But I left the church when I was a teenager and didn't go. I went back. I always wanted to go to church, but I couldn't find, it was the United Church. I couldn't find a pastor that I wanted to listen to every Sunday. And that's what stopped me. So it wasn't the religion, it was the church experience that I didn't find compelling. And so that's why I stopped. Now, I still don't go to church, but now mostly it's that because I'm traveling all the time. If I was here, I would join a church. Because I know that being part of a congregation is important. The community aspect of a church is largely what's important about going to church, is that you support one another, that you keep an eye on one another, you know, that you know when families are having trouble, then people can help. And so there's an aspect of church that we aren't a part of right now, but I do have plans.
But I often think faith is with us, you know, wherever you are, if you believe in something.
Yes. But that in a way is a, it's an idea that came with Protestantism that, and although I have learned that the Bible was disseminated largely because of Protestantism and the Gutenberg press, like both of those things just took the Bible everywhere in the world, it made the church less of a focal point because people were able to know that they had a personal relationship with God. And once we all had Bibles too, then we could have a personal relationship with God. And although having a personal relationship with God is necessary, it's not the only service, is the other side of it that's important, right? When you have a relationship with God, is what can I do? What can I, how can I be of service to myself, to the community, every day, to make my life and everyone else's life flourish? And so that's partly what church is for. And I'm not certain that church has kept up with the times, and there might have to be some work done in understanding what the purpose of church is now in this modern age, because so much of what people do now, they're so independent. You know, we have these telephones that are everything, mm-hmm. or they seem like they could be everything. And so people think, oh, well, I don't need face to face. I don't need to see people face to face anymore. And I think all of that is, I think it's a phase that we're going through. And we'll realize that that will not sustain us. No. We need each other in flesh and blood. We need each other deeply in flesh and blood.
We're truly isolating ourselves, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I went home to see my father. He's 92 now. And he's still at home, only because he lives with his wife, because she takes care of him. He couldn't do it on his own. And my sister actually is a palliative care nurse, and mm-hmm. she's moved to his community knowing that he would need her, which is a lovely gesture that she has made. And so I could go see my dad, but his short-term memory is no good. So you pretty much have to be there. You have to be there with him and tell him stories, and he can remember if he's engaged with you. But to do that on the telephone is very tricky. And then I have another sister who's got dementia. She doesn't speak at all. So if I don't go there and sit with her and hold her hand, I'm not with her. Mm. And with babies, you know, you can't be with children on a Zoom call, really. You have to be there and be able to poke them in the belly and tickle them and hold them and bounce them on your knee to be with them. So we really need each other in flesh and blood to have a fulfilled life. Mm. That's what I do anyway, for sure.
Well, I mean, that makes sense when you apply it to the church. You know, we can listen to prayers on a podcast, or we can physically be there and be a community together.
Yeah. And there's something about a church too, that with everyone in it, that intensifies the fact that God is there and that you can feel it. I know we went to a church service just outside of Cambridge in the UK. They have a cathedral, but it's not right inside of Cambridge. It's a little drive out. And one of the divinity professors at Cambridge took Jordan and I on Sunday morning to a service. Oh, yes. In their church. And it's a very large church. It goes way up, and it wasn't full. There were people there. It wasn't full. But as I sat there through the service, I could feel and this place, how old is it? It's probably from the 12th century, you know, I mean, and it's been of that purpose to bring people into a spiritual place for centuries. And I could feel that there. And so
if the walls could only speak.
Yeah.
Power.
Right. Right. That's for sure. But you go in there and meditate, and you can feel the faith.
Were you always intuitive? Did you believe in aura, energy around certain people and certain areas, environments?
I think I've always been a spiritual person. I did yoga, practiced yoga from the time I was 13, really up until the present. So, and I mostly practiced on my own. I only went to a yoga studio very, very rarely, mostly because I was from such a small town. I learned from books before there was internet.
No YouTube.
So, yeah, before there was YouTube, you know, I learned from books. I learned from Iyengar. He wrote a book called Light on Yoga. And he had courses in the back you could take. Mm-hmm. And it was really well documented. It was very well written. And so I learned very good Hatha Yoga, a very good techniques from him. And so in order to begin a practice of prayer, what wasn't hard for me because I'd been practicing meditation. I've been practicing silence, which is what you learn. Once I decided to practice prayer, I had to learn the prayers. But the practice of it, I was already pretty used to doing something every day. And so it wasn't hard for me. Once I realized how important it was that I keep up the practice from my own culture, then I started practicing prayer every day, which I've continued to do ever since I was ill. So that was 2019.
Tammy, before we get to your illness, how do you stay quiet and have peace when there's so much chaos around? You know, there's so much noise in our world today. How do you just shalom it all? Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to find a place. You know, when I'm on tour with Jordan, I get my own hotel room.
Oh, interesting.
So I have a place that's quiet. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were traveling around, and we're not traveling, we're living on the road. So it's not a trip, it's life. Mm-hmm. And we were sharing a room the whole time, and we would have never done that if we were at home. We wouldn't be together all the time. So I went home actually when we were in Detroit. We were close to Toronto and we were still on tour, but we were close to home, and I said, you know, I'm going to go home. And I got home and I thought, I don't know if I can go back on tour. This isn't working. But I asked, I prayed, I said, how can I go back on tour? What changes do I have to make in order to make this work? And what came to me was that I needed my own hotel room. And at first I thought my husband would be angry at me, that he would, I felt guilty. I felt guilty for having that need, that necessary need. But I talked to someone I trusted. I would say that she would be someone like a church friend. I can count on her to listen and to also tell me what she thinks. And she said, yes, that's what you need. Yes, that's what you need. Book it right away. And when I did, I booked it right away. And what had happened was that we were sharing a room. I would get back from the lecture at night at 10:30 at night. He'd get back at midnight. I'd already be asleep. I'd get up at 7 in the morning. He'd want to sleep. So I would get up in the dark. I wouldn't open the blinds. I would gather up some clothing and my rosary and like go out in the hallway and pray, go find a seat somewhere and pray. And I had a podcast. I wasn't scheduling any podcasts because he would have podcasts in the afternoon. And that's as much as you can do in one room, right? And so once I got my own room, I started opening the blinds in the morning. I could pray in my room. I started scheduling podcasts. I started doing Pilates instead of in the bathroom on a hard stone floor. I could do Pilates in my room. And it was, you know, and it sounds silly. It sounds silly that I was doing what I was doing before, but I never thought of it. I don't know. It was, whenever we had traveled in the past, we'd shared a room. So now we were traveling, share a room, but circumstances had changed. And part of me knew it had changed because I didn't want to be there anymore, but I didn't know why until I prayed about it. until I asked. I asked, truly, honestly asked, what do I have to do to continue on this tour? And an answer came and told me what I had to do. And I put that in place. And I would say it has improved our relationship, because now he can come back from the lecture and unwind in his room. He can sleep in later than me. I can get up when we want to spend time together. Then we can schedule it. And so we're not forced together. We're not forced together. We can come together voluntarily. And there's something to say for that. I don't know. It's been a very good compromise for both of us.
Yeah, that's such a different scenario, because oftentimes the other person might get upset. But yeah, that's great that you guys found that understanding within each other and said, this will work for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was worth a try, and it did work. It worked well.
What made you decide to go on tour instead of staying back at home and protecting the fort?
You have to imagine back in 2017 or 18, whenever 2017, when this all happened, the day it happened, the day he put out that first video on the Bill C-16 video, there were journalists speaking to him in the living room, waiting in the foyer, waiting in their cars outside, on the telephone with me, on the telephone with my son, and that never stopped. And as time went by and he decided to go on tour, I thought about it and I thought, well, I can either stay home or go on tour. If I go on tour, I think I can probably save my marriage. If I stay home, then he's probably gone. And so I went. Because it was such a departure from our life. You know, our life was thrown. He lost his job at the university. His clinical practice was done. He didn't have the focus, so he didn't see people anymore. Mm-hmm. And then he was going to go on tour. And so if I would have stayed at home, he was going to be gone for, I didn't know how long. As it turned out, we're traveling again from January until the end of May. And how are you going to stay married if you don't see each other at all? So it wasn't going to work if I didn't go.
When all of that happened, I mean, like you said, your life was so different before, you know.
Yes.
Jordan's a professor, raising kids, you're a massage therapist. Again, a normal Canadian family life.
Yeah.
When that happened, as a wife, as a mother, what were you like? Were you very upset of the situation in life, thinking, oh my God, this attention in our on our family, that stress?
It was, well, first of all, my son was home at the time. He had come home from university. So that was helpful because then I had someone else. We had someone else to talk to about it, because it was a big change that was going on. And I would say it's been a challenge for all of us, because my son's relationship with his father has changed because Jordan isn't around as much. So they used to spend quite a bit of time together playing ping pong. We have a ping pong table and we all like to play ping pong. So that's something that we would all do. We would have dinners together. We get along really well. So we would, and then all of a sudden we were busy and gone. And so it's been tricky for them to maintain a relationship, and for myself and Jordan and my son, we've had to be truthful for one another. So my son, just this last 6 months while we were away in Europe, contacted us and told us he was angry at us for being gone so much. And we thought, yeah. And I had thought the same thing. And we had had a conversation like, we can't do this continually. This isn't a life. Mm-hmm. So we have children and we have grandchildren. And we want that to be part of our life. So we're going to have to organize this part of our life to go with that part of our life. And so what we've kind of come to is that we're going to travel between November and May, and we're not going to travel between June and October. And so that's when we can see our family, and that's when we can, that's when we can enjoy the people that we love, spend time with the people that we love, and also have a routine at home mm-hmm. where we can do things that we're interested in other than working. Because really when we're touring, it's just work. We're working.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we hear that phrase, you got to put that oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on anybody else. Mm-hmm. It's like, you got to take care of home first. And again, you guys had taken a minute to realize this is how we need to design our lives to make it work for your son and your family and everybody else. That's interesting. Did you have to move from where you live because of all the chaos after that video?
We haven't moved, but I would say that it's my son moved. Mm-hmm. He was living in our neighborhood and he moved away. Now he wanted to have a bit larger family. So he wanted a larger house and he wanted to be down by the lakeshore, close to the water. Mm-hmm. So now they're a 10-minute walk from the water, which is really nice for them and their dog and their little kids. Mm-hmm. So they get to go play on the beach. I think that was a very good idea, but now he's not in the neighborhood anymore and we're not here very often. And because things are different now, in our lives, we don't have the relationships we have with the people on the street. Is in some ways it's strained, but it's definitely changed. Mm-hmm. And so that has made us wonder about living here.
Sure.
Yeah. But we're still here.
You're still here.
And we're happy. We like the house. It's just that the circumstances of being in the city have changed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what we'll do yet.
For sure. And also when you get out there more, privacy is so important, so vital. We take it for granted, don't we, at times, our privacy?
Yeah, well, you know, before Jordan was a public figure, we had lots of privacy. And now we pretty much have no privacy. And that's a change. And it's something that people don't know can disappear. You know, you think, oh, these people, their lives have changed and it's all for the better. And that's not how it is. You know, it's people who are very famous. They never go out. They never go outside anymore. And Jordan isn't that famous, so we can still go outside. But it's and Jordan, he's a remarkable person. He's a very gracious person. Mm-hmm. He is always, no matter how much of a rush we're in, if someone recognizes him and wants to say hello, he says hello. And he doesn't just say hello. He finds out who they are and how they're doing. And I think that's particular to who he is. Mm-hmm. He's just that compassionate a person. And he's smart to know that as a public figure, he has a responsibility when someone recognizes him to be present, honest, and sincere. And that will go a long ways.
Oh, yes. You know, but in this day and age, it's scary. I mean, someone could pull out a phone and be like, to both of you, wanting to catch you into something or bait you into something negative. How do you avoid situations where people come up wanting a confrontation and it's not the right time or place?
All the confrontation is online.
Ah, interesting.
All the in-person... Oh, yesterday we were at the airport and we met the members of Boney M. You know the band Boney M from the 70s? You have to look up. It's a British band from the 70s and they're still touring.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and they're touring. They're in Hamilton tonight.
Oh, yes. Look at this.
So we
Oh yeah,
met
they are. Yeah.
yesterday. That was very cool.
Super cool.
Super cool, yeah. Then they
That's
might be
awesome.
heading west. I don't know, but I would recommend seeing them.
Yeah.
I was a big fan. I told them I was a big fan.
That's amazing. When you guys go to the airports, is it different now as well? Do you guys have to almost disguise yourselves or a hat or low key?
Jordan doesn't wear hats. He doesn't wear hats.
Oh.
He's out there, and he's so extroverted, and he doesn't mind. I mean, he's still amazed that I think people recognize him. But all the interactions we have are so, they're the people are very gracious. They always ask if they're bothering us. They are hesitant to, they say that, maybe they're getting in our way because it's our private time, but we don't feel that way. And the Jordan especially is, he knows he's a public figure and he knows what his responsibilities are, and he accepts that, and he's grateful. He's grateful.
Tammy, I don't know where you were, but you had posted something of a almost like a riot where there's gates and police holding individuals back. I think it was in Germany,
Oh,
actually.
is that in Germany? Oh, did I post that video? Yeah.
Or
Yeah, we
picture, I
went
think it was a
outside. There were
picture.
300 protesters, but they had fenced them off. Those are the Germans, right? They fence off their protesters, and they brought in police dressed in
Riot.
here, and we felt safe. We were safe. They were yelling. Most of it was in German. All I could hear was, neo-fascist, or that's about all I could hear. But that was the biggest protest we had. The other protest we may have had in Australia, we had six people one night. Hardly any protesters at all. Really, all the trouble is online. All the trouble is trolls, online trolls, people who are just trying to cause trouble that they would never do it in public because they'd get punched. And so that's where all the trouble is.
You're so right. People don't talk to people like that in person, ever.
No way. They would never get away with it. So it's something that social media still has to grow up and address, is the fact that these people who have they have no followers. They haven't done any work to try to build an audience, and they have the same reach as anybody else. In fact, if they comment on someone's platform who has millions of viewers, then they have millions of viewers all of a sudden. So it really isn't set up, because in real life that would never happen. So it's a very odd, and it's not a realistic way of social interaction. The social media, it's a very strange new way, and we don't understand it. And who knows how much trouble it's causing, because there is so much disinformation and just
And it's like a gang-like
trouble.
mentality. It's like if
Yes,
someone says
gang-like,
something bad, they
despicable.
all tag along and attack someone very viciously. And oftentimes they don't have their picture up, profile picture, their name, nothing about them. And you're
Yes.
thinking you're hiding to take, be mean. I mean, that negative energy within you to say that stuff to somebody, good gosh.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, he looked at, oh, he doesn't know how many comments, but thousands and thousands of comments, because he was trying to understand social media. And he came to the conclusion that anybody who has a false name, and usually the name is a little derogatory, right? It's
Yes.
not a nice name. And they use things like LOL or WTF or they say things like sunshine. They call people sunshine, derogatory names. And those are trolls. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to be listened to. They don't have to be answered or listened to, paid any attention to, because they're just trying to cause trouble. You can't communicate with them. They don't want to. They just want to
harm,
rile you up. And so this is something that Elon Musk is going to have to.
Oh, yes.
You know, he's going to have to see what do I do with people like that? And he's trying, right? He's decided mm-hmm. he's going to have people pay to be identified users. But Jord thinks that what they should do is they should have one section that's identified users and another section that's anonymous. And so if you want to go and talk to the anonymous people, you can, but you shouldn't be forced to.
I like that.
And they can have their own. So we'll see how it gets figured out, but it definitely has to be done.
Do you guys look at the comments often?
I'll look at the comments from my YouTube, like from my podcast. I'll always look at the comments from my podcast. Yeah.
How do you know when to answer them and when they're just trying to pull your leg here?
Yeah. Well, I've struggled with that for sure. I think when someone is, if they're not adding anything to the conversation, then they're just trying to cause trouble. And if they're just kind of trying to cause trouble, then I just block them.
Oh, yeah. Well, we started engaging because of a post I had placed up on Emily Carr's painting that was.
Oh, is that right?
With maple syrup on it.
Oh, okay. Yes. I said something about that, did I?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me mad. I'm an artist. That makes me, you know, I adore Van Gogh and mm-hmm. Emily Carr and many, many, many.
The Group of Seven, Tom Thompson. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. The Group of Seven. And I can't believe that we're letting people deface paintings. That's got to stop too. That's a criminal action as far as I'm concerned.
Thank goodness they had a piece of glass on the Emily Carr.
Yes.
That's a close call, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And they have defaced, I think, some. And I don't know if they can be saved, but
you know,
and they're sticking themselves to. It's ludicrous, really. It's mm-hmm. ludicrous.
I don't think that's the way you get your message across. Even if you have a message, feel free to say it. Just there's other ways.
Well, it's not very articulate, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I saw a gal the other week. She glued herself to the tarmac, and you know, they had to change air traffic control and planes landing. Really? I said, how did you get here? On a bus. What? I'm not even going down there, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw a video of people. There were some oil activists sitting cross-legged on the highway mm-hmm. and motorists coming and dragging them off the highway. People are starting to get upset enough to make it to change things, you mm-hmm. know, and to pull them out of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting out of hand. And the thing is, if we don't take action now, we have to make sure that we don't mm-hmm. have it escalate so much that it becomes sure. more of a problem and that people get hurt.
So Tammy, in 07, you had kidney cancer, is that correct?
Let's see, when was it? It wasn't very long ago. No, it was in 2019.
Just recently, yeah.
Just recently, yeah.
And you were told you don't have long to live.
I was told I had 10 months to live. They did the first surgery. They thought I had a treatable cancer. Okay. Carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, mm-hmm. which lots of people get, and it grows a millimeter a year. And so they told me not to worry about it. And so we finished up our tour the first year, and then I came back for surgery, and I had the surgery. And they took out a part of my left kidney. But when they biopsied it, they found out that it wasn't the type of cancer that they thought. And then they noticed it went into my lymph gland. And so then they had to take out my entire kidney and all the lymph on the left side. So it was much more invasive mm-hmm. and much more, it was in much more of an emergency the second time. And that's really when I went home, the doctor told me that he thought I was going to die. And I went home to tell my son I was going to die. But when I got there and looked at him, I don't even know. I may have said that I was going to die. I don't even remember if I said it. But I realized at that moment that that wasn't anything that I had the control of to say, because I don't know when I'm going to die. And the doctor has an opinion, but the doctor isn't God. And I don't know why I was treating him like God. I think we're taught to treat our doctors like gods. But the doctor had an opinion, and I was accepting his opinion. But when I got home to tell my son, I realized, oh, wait a minute. That was his opinion. It's not up to me to accept anything that doesn't come straight from God. It just seemed obvious to me now, and I don't know how it came to me, but I think partly it was all those lectures, sitting in Jordan's lectures for probably 200 lectures and listening to what he had to say, you know, and living with him for 30 years. And then now listening to his, because although I was married to him, he didn't share all his thoughts with me, but on this tour, he was sharing all his thoughts with everyone. And I realized that I had been believing that I could decide what my destiny would be. And when I said that to my, when I was going to say that to my son, I realized that that was arrogant to think that I have that much knowledge. I don't have that much knowledge. That's a whole different, you know, I have control about, I don't even have control about when I wake up or not. You know, that's not even my choice. I can decide when I'm going to eat and when I'm not going to eat. You know, I have some things. I can decide if I'm going to go to the bathroom or not going to go to the bathroom. I can decide if I'm going to be kind or if I'm going to, you know, be aggressive with someone. I can make those kinds of decisions, but I can't decide if I'm going to live or die. That's way beyond me, right? And it just, at that moment, I just realized how beyond me it was. And because it wasn't about me ever before, it had to be about me. I had to see it from my point of view and realize, oh no, it's a very selfish thought that I can make that decision. And it was such a relief. Actually, I could feel the world came right off my shoulders because I realized that it wasn't up to me. What was up to me was to be grateful with the time I had left and to accept help wherever it may come from and to pray for God's will through all the scans and all the blood work and all the cold nights, because I lost so much weight. You know what I've realized recently? So I weighed about 120 and I got down to 90 pounds. So I'd lost 30 pounds and I'm only 5'2". So I'm really small. And I realized recently that I have starvation syndrome. So I had a hole in my lymph system. And so all my bodily fluids, all the nutrition from what I would eat would drain into my body. And so slowly I was starving. And I lost all that weight. And I took pictures of myself. It's like, yep, that's definitely somebody who's starving. I mean, my shoulder blades were sticking off my back. My bum was gone. My breasts were gone. My cheeks were gone. Like I was starving. And I prayed through all of that. And I really wasn't afraid, because I really had a very strong faith that God was taking care of me. However he was going to take care of me, I didn't know how it was going to go, but I trusted that whatever was supposed to happen was supposed to happen, and I would just accept it. But since then, I've had three occurrences now that I thought were rage, that I was feeling rage, but actually what I was feeling was terror. So I have a syndrome now that people who starve to death have. So if I feel like I'm not going to, and it's very strange. I'll give you just one example. So the night before the show one night, I didn't have a very good dinner and I didn't eat very much. So by the next morning, I was quite hungry. And I had planned, when the bus came, because we were touring by bus, I'd get on the bus and I'd eat something. But my husband called me and he said, I'm tired this morning. I'd like to sleep for another couple of hours. And I said, oh, well, I'm really hungry. Can you sleep on the bus? And he said, no, I'd really like to just continue to sleep. And I said, yeah, okay. And I hung up the phone and I felt this, what I thought was rage, but I've never had rage, so I didn't know what rage felt like. But I thought that's what it was, because it was a full body feeling of adrenaline or something. I didn't know what it was. And I sat down and I prayed. And then I got a text from one of our workers. Oh, Jordan told me you're hungry. Do you want me to go cook you some food? And it was like, see, all I had to do was wait, and the answer came. I didn't have to do anything or worry or anything. All I did was pray. But I've had this feeling, which I've had a couple other times. I realized that I'm now starting to, like, we have carnivore crisps that we eat, okay. We buy, and I have them like stashed in my suitcase, because I'm afraid when we cross the border that they'll take my carnivore crisps and then I'll have nothing to eat. Mm. And this thing I thought was rage is terror of not getting food. And Jordan said, oh, the Dutch actually had that, because they had a famine in Holland. And after that, people had what's this starvation syndrome, where they hoard food. And some of them did that for the rest of their lives, hoarded food. And so I was just one night obsessing about how I was going to take the plane, and then the border guards were going to take my carnivore crisps. And I was thinking, oh, not this again, because here I am in the middle of the night worrying about carnivore crisps again. And then I realized, oh, this is because I think I'm going to starve. And that's why I'm thinking about this. So then I told Jordan, he said, sure, that's a thing. That's a psychological syndrome that people have from being traumatized from not having any food. I thought, oh, okay, well. So I didn't get away scot-free from my illness. I have a few things that I have to still deal with, but then again, I'm figuring them out little by little.
Yeah. It did change your perspective on life, and to realize that life is truly short and what is meaningful and what's not.
Well, it's a daily practice. I can only really focus on the next thing that I'm doing. And if I don't understand what it is, or if I'm upset about what's going on, then I step back and I pause and I don't do anything until it's clear what the next step should be. And that will come by someone telling me, or something happening, or an insight that I have. But I'll wait I'll wait for that and I won't impose my will. And then that's where the meaning comes, because I can find the meaning in the world, or I can find the meaning in the next moment. If I don't impose my will, the meaning will come. And then there's also when there's a challenge now and it's too much for me, I can ask for courage and strength and face those challenges. Just as when I go on stage, you know, when I go on stage, I ask for courage and strength. I can go out there and I can speak to a bunch of people. There's lots of people out there and they don't have to listen to me. They're there to listen to Jordan. And I'm asking them to spend 10 minutes with me. You know, it's not, that's not what they've paid for. So I have to ask for courage and strength to go out there and to add something to their day that is genuine and worthwhile them knowing before I invite Dr. Peterson on stage, you know. So finding meaning in your life is a constant, it's a constant challenge. But if you do what is necessary as each day goes by, you don't know where it'll get you to, but it will get you where you need to go.
It's true.
Yeah, it's quite miraculous, really, that is the way it is. I never would have thought that, because I was always a planner. I was always making sure that everything went the way that I thought it might go and stuff. I don't do that anymore. It seems that's insufficient.
Flow, not force.
Yes. And Jordan and I have talked about that too. If we're on tour and we have quite a tight schedule, if we're on tour and another opportunity comes, and they do, right? They come. But you're trying to wedge it in between two other things that you're doing that you've already decided to do. We're not going to do that anymore, because we are deciding to force something. It's not going to go well. So there's no forcing anymore.
It works out. If it doesn't, next time.
Yes, that's right. Or, you know, maybe it's a good opportunity, but maybe the time is wrong. No, so absolutely. We'll see if next time the time is wrong.
Exactly. Well, thank you again, Tammy, for this. I truly appreciate it.
Oh, it was very nice talking to you. You're easy to talk to.
Thank you very much.
That'd be fun. Awesome. Okay.
Bye, Tammy.
Bye-bye. Take care.